From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, the staffing of Michigan's hospitals as exhausted, under-equipped nurses consider their options.
The money talks eventually. You know, when you're overworked and understaffed, you're going to go somewhere where they're going to probably be more appreciative of you.
Also, disparities in COVID death rates. They say a lot about how African Americans fare in the public health system.
There are so many lessons that can be brought down, I think, both practical but also emotional. Disease is not just about biology.
And we talk about tiger wellness and other COVID-era concerns at the Detroit Zoo.
We always assume that anything that humans have potentially could be passed on to great apes, but this was new to us, new to the Bronx Zoo, and I think new to the scientific community.
Zoo CEO Ron Kagan is among our guests. These stories are coming up on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today on the show, we'll be speaking with the head of the Detroit Zoo about the phenomenon of COVID-19 showing up in animals and what the conservation community is looking at amid the pandemic. But first, Michigan finds itself in desperate need of more nurses and other healthcare workers to handle the surge of new coronavirus patients filling Detroit area hospitals. Staffing is a real problem right now. And the two field hospitals in develop to serve the area haven't even opened yet. Joining us now are Michigan Radio's Kate Wells and Will Callen. They've been reporting on these issues for us. Will, Kate, welcome to Stateside.
Hey, April.
Hey, April.
Kate, a little earlier this week, there was an incident where emergency room nurses walked out at Detroit Medical Center's Sinai Grace Hospital. What was going on there?
Yeah, so this was actually a Facebook Live video that one of the night shift nurses at DMC Sinai Grace took when they had just staged a four-hour sit-in, they said, over what they said were really low levels of staffing to the point where it got dangerous.
We've had three straight weeks with over 110 patients and an average of 12 to 14 nurses at night that drops down to about 8 nurses. And they keep, and we've been accepting that and working hard. But tonight, it was the breaking point for us because we cannot safely take care of your loved ones out here.
And April, I am told that they did eventually go back to work is what I'm hearing. But the point that they were making is essentially that so many nurses are feeling right now, which is feeling like they are just drowning in work, obviously. These nurses in particular were saying that they had two nurses caring for 26 patients in the ER, 10 of whom were on ventilators. I ran that by other staff at DMC Sinai Grace who said, yeah, that sounded about right. And these ERs especially are really becoming these dumping grounds because the other floors are full and the other floors can essentially say to the ER, look, we can't take any of your patients. So nurses in these ERs are saying that they've got patients who are waiting there in critical care on ventilators for up to 5 days. It's really impacting the kind of care that people can get.
And in the meantime, in the middle of what must be some of the most intense weeks of their lives, nurses have standing offers in states like New York and Massachusetts, where hospitals are offering nurses more money to come work there. Is there a bidding war going on right now for these critical staff?
Well, yes and no. So if you are a nurse right now and you are willing to leave the state of Michigan, you can definitely make more money over the next few weeks working at a place like New York or Massachusetts, where they're offering nurses around $6,000, $5,000 per week. And that includes, you know, food and travel stipends. And I talked to one nurse who, you know, really loved her team here in Detroit, but she just ultimately felt like she was not being supported and went and took the opportunity in New York.
The money talks eventually. You know, when you're overworked and understaffed, you're going to go somewhere where they're going to probably be more appreciative of you. You know, I'm at a facility in New York right now where none of the problems that are going on at Grace are existent.
Which, and that really surprised me, April, right? Because we've heard all of these horror stories coming out of New York right now. And this may not be true of every hospital, but this nurse was saying that at least where she is, she has more staff than she did at the Detroit area hospitals. They were actually less hard hit than some of these smaller places. I talked with another nurse who was weighing offers through 6 different staffing agencies. It's definitely an opportunity that some nurses are looking at more, but obviously not everybody can just leave their families and the state. And we should mention, you know, that these are temporary contracts. Those contracts will end when this pandemic ends, one assumes. And some nurses, you know, don't want to leave their more permanent jobs. But it's been interesting to see how those offers compare with the same contracts that are being offered right now at Michigan hospitals that also desperately need these workers, and the convention centers that are being turned into field hospitals, like you mentioned up the top. You know, they are just not offering as much money as New York or Massachusetts or some other states.
It's just incredible. Will, Governor Whitmer made an announcement yesterday that Ascension Health will be collaborating with the state on a second field hospital in the Detroit suburbs. But we got to back up here a minute. What's going on with the first field hospital, the one that's taking shape at the TCF Center in Detroit? Is that one fully staffed?
So it might be, but we're not getting totally clear answers on that question from MDHHS, even though the TCF Center Field Hospital, it's supposed to open this week. What we do know is where, in general, the staff will be coming from, and there will be staff coming from both the state and federal levels. So for the state, about 10 days ago, Governor Whitmer put out a call for volunteers, and so far we're hearing that 14,000 people have responded. So that's 5,000 medical workers, it's 5,000 public health professionals, and about 4,000 community service volunteers, so people who could do stuff like deliver groceries, collect PPE donations, that sort of thing. But we want to keep in mind that these volunteers can be committing anywhere between, you know, 4 and 12 hours a day. We don't know where they are in the state of Michigan. We're just not getting that information from MDHHS yet. But what we do know is that those volunteers are not enough to staff the field hospital.
Is there a federal agency that might be in an obvious position to help out with this?
The state of Michigan has requested support from FEMA on this. So they've told FEMA that, look, our local resources are insufficient. So what we need is for you to go out and assess our options at the federal level. So FEMA is reportedly doing that right now. So again, we don't know exactly where this staffing support is going to come from, but a few likely options are the Department of Defense, which we've seen the DOD deploy, you know, medical units in both New York and Washington State. You know, I'm hearing that there's a chance that some Army medical teams will be working in the TCF Center. Another federal agency that could provide support is the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. So one office that falls under USHHS is called the USPHS Commissioned Corps. And this is a team that has a bunch of, you know, specialized medical units that can be deployed on fairly short notice. They've also been deployed in Washington State. But again, we don't have confirmation which federal agencies are going to be sending the backup. All we know is that FEMA is working on it at the moment. So Kate was talking about these private staffing agencies a bit earlier, and so we also know that the state is working with private staffing agencies in order to find nurses and doctors who can fill these roles at the TCF Center. But we also know that hospitals themselves are working with private staffing agencies. You know, we heard from DMC and Sparrow that they're working with agencies to make sure that they're filling their staffing needs right now. And then another problem they're facing is they need to retain their current employees, just as the case that Kate was talking about with out-of-state options being financially attractive to healthcare workers here in Michigan. You know, a job at the TCF Center is probably going to be a lot more lucrative than a job at the hospital you're working at right now. Because they're able to pay crisis rates, which, you know, can range from, you know, $5 to $20 more per hour. So what this is doing, and it's creating a dynamic where these public field hospitals and private facilities are competing for workers. And then on top of that, of course, they're competing with the out-of-state options, which are making offers that they're not exactly able to match.
Well, Kate, in terms of how all these frontline nurses are doing, I don't think we have much to compare this to unless some of them had worked in New York City in September of 2001. The nurses you spoke with, what's your impression of how they're actually doing?
You know, the thing that I hear over and over from nurses is, and really all healthcare workers on these front lines right now, is they're of two minds. On one hand, this is what they do, and they want to be caring for people. They want to be helping. They are incredibly hardworking, and they are used to making do with not enough supplies or staff or whatever it is. They also feel a tremendous obligation to their coworkers and teams, which is why it's so hard as more and more staff are getting sick. And as we saw over the weekend and last week, even here in Michigan, you know, we're losing healthcare workers. These are people that they, you know, showed up to work with every single day. On the other hand, they're drowning. You know, you talk to these workers about just the emotional trauma of what they're seeing right now. They have bodies just in body bags that are being wheeled through the halls. I talked to one nurse who was caring for a guy who she just couldn't, he was critically ill, and she just had too many other critically ill patients to be able to give him the kind of time she wanted to give him. And she says that he just said, "Help me," over and over for 12 hours during her entire shift. I think we're really going to look back whenever this is over and see a tremendous need among these frontline workers for therapy, for PTSD support. You know, like you said, we've really never seen anything like this.
Kate Wells is a reporter for Michigan Radio. We also heard from the newsroom's Will Callen. Kate, Will, thank you so much for the work that you're doing right now and for taking the time to bring this one to us.
Thanks, April.
Thanks, April.
Coming up, a tiger in the Bronx Zoo has tested positive for COVID-19 after exhibiting symptoms. After the break, we'll talk to the head of the Detroit Zoo about the health of his zoo's animals.
We always assume that anything that humans have potentially could be passed on to great apes, but this was new to us, new to the Bronx Zoo, and I think new to the scientific community.
And we'll discuss how the pandemic may shape the global dialogue around conservation issues. Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. When a tiger at the Bronx Zoo tested positive for COVID-19, it sent shivers through animal lovers all over the United States. We were curious how the well-known residents of Michigan zoos are holding up in the pandemic, to say nothing of the human systems that keep the zoos running. Ron Kagan is the CEO of the Detroit Zoological Society, and he joins us now. Ron, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you. Good morning.
Have there been any concerns about illnesses in big cats at the Detroit Zoo or really any other animals?
Well, until the situation happened in New York, we were not aware that there was a risk to cats. We always assume that anything that humans have potentially could be passed on to great apes. So, like every other accredited zoo, we always take special precautions when caring for primates, but this was new to us, new to the Bronx Zoo, and I think new to the scientific community.
Well, wait a minute. What is that? I'm trying to imagine what the precautions look like. I mean, you can't have chimpanzees using hand sanitizer. Can you?
No, but you can have the staff using that. So normally what we are concerned with is the phenomenon of zoonotic disease transmission. So, you know, in lay terms, that just means that there are certain diseases, bacteria, viruses, etc., that can be transmitted from non-human animals to humans, from animals to humans. And in this case, we're now learning that there is the potential for reverse zoonosis. That the transmission from humans to animals.
So what have you learned about that?
Well, we've known, I mean, I think people may not understand that coronaviruses are actually quite common in the environment, and they affect many species. They affect humans, they affect many, many species of animals, and of course there's a lot we don't know, so there's probably a lot more that are affected that we aren't aware of, but even the common cold is generated by a type of human coronavirus. They often do affect upper respiratory systems. Sometimes intestinal situations are problematic too. But this has not been, this is called a novel coronavirus for a reason. This is new, this particular strain of coronavirus. And so clearly what we've seen in New York, well, I shouldn't say clearly, but it seems overwhelming in terms of the evidence that this was a human being who had COVID-19, who was working with the big cats there, and apparently they have developed it. Now, the big cats don't appear, although it's a small sample size, don't appear to get sick exactly in the same way that humans do, although it is affecting their upper respiratory system.
Hmm. To your knowledge, are the animals at the Detroit Zoo healthy right now?
As far as we know, they're healthy, and so is the staff. And we obviously, just like New York, we take lots of precautions. So one of the ways to make sure they stay safe, you asked about the chimps washing their hands. Well, we do that, and we also wear PPE. So people are wearing masks and gloves, and you know there are all sorts of protocols, both in terms of keeping people away from each other, the staff here, and also keeping a distance from the animals and making sure that everything that the animals have access to is clean.
Sure. There's been so much discussion around essential workers in hospitals and grocery stores and delivery services. I think the public tends to regard the zoo as something fun and leisurely. But what does work look like these days at the zoo?
Well, you're right. The zoo is fun and leisurely, but it's also it's such an interesting blend of activities for one organization to do because we're just like a healthcare system. In a healthcare system, you've got doctors and nurses and obviously patients that require care 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. For a zoo, we have the same thing. We have here 2,500 animals. The difference, of course, here is that we don't have to just deal with one species. We have hundreds of different species. So the complexity of that, the technical complexity of it is enormous, and there's nowhere nearly as much knowledge as there is with human healthcare. So we're operating like a healthcare system. We're also a major tourism venue, again, as is the case with any other major accredited zoo. So we have to operate for that. We're also an education system, and we're serving over 100,000 students in various educational programs, aside from all the informal education. So there are a lot of different businesses going on simultaneously, and they have to work together. When the zoo is closed, it doesn't mean that we've stopped operations, because we can't. We can't just close down and warehouse animals. So all of the fundamentals of animal care are still very much in play, and so half our staff are absolutely essential. All of our staff's amazing, but half of them we just can't safely do anything without having those people here.
Right. The zoo is funded in part through donations and part through public money that I believe comes in terms of a millage, correct?
Right, right.
How much of your annual budget is based on ticket sales? I've got to believe the shutdown is having an effect on the financial model for the zoo.
Oh, it's a huge problem for us. The regional millage provides somewhere between 25 and 30% of our funding. The rest is all from admissions and parking, memberships, sponsorships, all sorts of things which are tied into us being open to the public. So for us, I'd say every month right now, we're losing somewhere between $2 and $3 million of revenue. So this is a massive hit to us. I know it's the same pretty much for any enterprise, but you know, we don't know how long that is going to last, obviously, and it's a big problem.
What do you think you're going to have to do about the financial loss?
Well, we've already taken a few steps, which every step you take is more pain. We laid off about half of our staff. We're hoping to bring back most people whenever this situation resolves and however it resolves. We've also cut back on all the other expenditures that we can. I mean, we can't cut back on food. We can't cut back on water and, you know, various other basics. So we're doing what we can to operate safely, but it's extremely challenging. And obviously, we've been retraining everybody because all of us who are still here are now having to do multiple jobs. And there's a big focus on emergency preparedness, which we normally do, but we're doing even more of it now. So it's challenging, but again, it's challenging for everyone in society.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Detroit Zoological Society CEO Ron Kagan about the possibility of viral transmission of COVID-19 between humans and animals. And we're discussing conservation efforts amid the global pandemic. There's no question that the pandemic has disrupted life as most of us know it. And you've been on the show speaking to us previously about global solutions for climate change. Could you foresee this disruption changing the direction of our conversation on the kind of scale that you and others believe is might be necessary?
Oh, what a great question. I really hope that's one of the good outcomes, and realizing that there doesn't look like there are going to be many good outcomes of this, but this raises the issue of whether, as a society, whether we are going to attempt to be prepared for the future and to some extent intentionally shape our future as opposed to being victims of our own activities with no real proper regard for the future. And that, I think, could play out in a lot of different ways. So, for instance, one of them could be on the climate change issue, certainly on our relationship with animals. So the start of all of this coronavirus issue is, as far as we know, what are called wet markets in Asia, but they're wet markets in many other places around the world, where there are lots and lots of wild animals that are in a marketplace for sale, primarily for food. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we need to get to a point where we have a very different relationship with nature. And again, that's going to hopefully influence how we deal with climate change and thinking beyond the next few weeks or few months, and really think about what's going to happen. Because from my perspective, what we see for COVID-19 pales in comparison to what life will be like if sea levels, and it's not just about sea levels, but if sea levels go up 20 feet, 40 feet, 60 feet, I mean, you know, hundreds and hundreds of millions of people will either be killed or will be incredibly devastated by it. And that's all right now what is going to happen unless we completely change things.
Are there conversations happening among conservationists about how to organize coming out of this? I know everyone is sort of in survival mode at the moment.
No, actually, you're right. It is being discussed very actively. I give lots of credit to organizations like the Humane Society, HSUS, and Humane Society International. They've been working on these issues for a long time. I think the U.S. Zoo and Aquarium community, there's a lot of dialogue that's going on among our colleagues right now of how to make sure that we're able to effectively communicate these issues. So there are lots and lots of ways that we hope ultimately people do view us, as you described, as, you know, fun and enjoyable experiences. But we also do a lot of serious work. We're trying to, you know, have an impact in terms of conservation. We're trying to have an impact in terms of public policy. And we need, hopefully people will now pay a lot more attention to these issues.
I'm seeing all kinds of photos popping up on folks' social media feeds of wildlife strolling casually through spaces where we're not used to seeing them. Deer and coyotes, turkeys sometimes. Should this be a surprise that when humans stay home, animals are getting out and about?
Well, I think it's kind of obvious that they were here first. So, you know, this really was their environment before we arrived. And I think it's wonderful. I think it's, you know, you also see a lot of environmental improvements too. You've seen clean air over lots of cities, and because, you know, factories have shut down and people aren't driving. And so there's a lot of really interesting stuff happening. You know, for all of us, really, we've just got to pay a lot more attention to the impact that we have and make sure that what we're doing is a positive, not a negative. It would be wonderful to have wildlife around on a regular basis, not simply when places are deserted.
We've spent so much time talking about getting outside and that people can reconnect with nature as one way to spend this time alone. A lot of your life is interacting with nature in some form. I know that you're responsible for an awful lot of people and animals right now. I don't know if you have a lot of spare time, but what does connecting with nature look like for you right now?
Well, so again, I think you've raised a wonderful point, because everyone right now is really scared, and the reality is that nature is our friend. E.O. Wilson, who's a famous biologist at Harvard, coined the term many years ago of biophilia, which is the innate human love of nature. And of course, there are exceptions. There are some people who really just don't like nature, but the vast majority of us, we can't help ourselves. Why do so many people have dogs and cats? You know, we absolutely love animals. So that's a good thing. And it is wonderfully therapeutic. In fact, a few hours after the tragedy of 9/11, our zoo, and I think many others around the country, our zoo was filled with people. People know that nature is healing and that nature is kind of our balance. So we want to encourage that. We want people to remember how much they love nature. I am very, very fortunate because I am surrounded by it. And when I need a little bit of nourishment, I go up to our butterfly garden and, you know, feel like I'm in the Garden of Eden without the snake. And I'll go visit our donkeys and we'll chat or sing, depending on the day. You know, it's awesome. I mean, I really can't think of anything that's more wonderful and healthier. And I think also your point just about fresh air, this got really lost to some extent. We are by far healthier if we are outdoors. Now, obviously not in a blizzard, but sunshine and fresh air are enormously healthy for us. And there's plenty of evidence to suggest that UV light kills most organisms like viruses and bacteria. So being outside, especially if it's sunny, is a really good thing for people to do. Obviously respecting social distancing, but what I think everyone understands is that we don't want to become socially isolated. We just need to distance ourselves, and we don't want to be isolated from nature either.
Mr. Kagan, thank you very much for your work and for your time today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
That was Ron Kagan, CEO of the Detroit Zoological Society. You know, yesterday, we asked you to send us some pictures of the natural world rediscovering its habitats in your neck of the woods. We received several pictures of wild turkeys and other birds, including this video of sandhill cranes calling to each other in a listener's backyard. Thanks to Don for sending us that video. We also received pictures of cranes flying over an empty golf range from a listener named Chris. Cranes are migrating through the state right now, and Chris says, I doubt they'll try to breed on the golf course, but at least they can rest and feed there now that humans aren't driving them away. Special thanks to everyone who sent us pictures so far. How about you? What else have you seen in your yard or your neighborhood that was unexpected? Have pheasants returned to places that you hadn't seen them in recent years? Maybe a herd of deer springing up in the suburbs or a coyote crossing your street? We'd love to see your pictures if you have them. Send them to stateside@michiganradio.org. Coming up, we'll talk about some of the alarming demographics around COVID infections and death rates.
We have to unpack and kind of fix the things that have been deeply baked in, the actual root of the inequality that brought people to this table to begin with.
Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm April Baer. To try to prevent the spread of COVID-19, Governor Whitmer issued an executive order asking Michigan residents to stay safe and stay home starting on March 24th. But how do you obey that order when you don't have a home? Reporter Laura Herberg was working on a story at the State Fair Bus Transit Center in Detroit, and she was approached by a man wearing a bright yellow jacket, garden gloves, and a mask that was so worn out it was translucent in parts. That man's name is Jerome Driscoll.
You were shooting a movie or something?
Oh, no. I'm with the radio station. I'm just talking to folks, checking in. Mm-hmm. How are you doing during this pandemic?
Holding on, sweetheart, holding on. Trying to keep warm.
Yeah, tell me what you're doing to stay safe.
Going here and there, going in abandoned houses, checking me a little blanket or something, and go to sleep.
So are you homeless then?
Yep, staying away from people. Right about now, I had a little house. I mean, you know, I was squatting in it, and they came and shut it down. And I had my electricity on. I've been out here about a week.
Who shut your house down and why?
I was in an abandoned house, so actually it was city-owned. So when they came in and just shut it down. I had lights on illegal. I called myself living good. But you never know. You could be up one minute, down next minute. I'm going to make it, though. Right now, I'm just riding around trying to keep warm. That's what a lot of people doing while they're riding the buses. They're trying to keep warm. Sometimes the bus drivers be rude because they know that's what you're doing. So you wait for the next one and then keep going around till you keep warm. Then go to a shelter and get you something to eat or something. I called the shelter to get in, but all the shelters crowded.
So where are you going to sleep tonight?
I got a little abandoned house I found. I'm going to go in. I got a blanket in to go in there, cover up, and keep warm. Well, if it was warm, it would be no problem. But it's kind of chilly. You get dropping down to 32. And that's one time.
So everybody's saying part of staying safe right now is washing your hands. So how are you washing your hands?
Well, I wash my hands. I got me some water. Give me, if I can find water, anything, pick them up and keep it. I keep me some soap, and I try to keep washing my hands and face at all times. At all times. I keep my gloves on. You see, I got a mask on. I don't want to die like the next man, you know what I'm saying? And hopefully this plague will be over. I don't know when it's going to be over, but hopefully it'll be over.
This pandemic is scary to all of us right now, but I can't imagine, on top of dealing with the pandemic, you're dealing with not having a home right now.
Right. My phone is down. I'm going to go down to the shelter tomorrow and find out. I'm going to ask them, because I use their phone to find out why my phone cut off. It just suddenly cut off. And I don't know what the problem is, so I'm going to find out tomorrow. You know, just trying to survive, you know, and then you got to go. You can't cook you nothing regular to eat. I done lost about 30 pounds. I don't have no stove or refrigerator, so I have to go in these little gas stations and stuff and buy a little hot sandwich, and they want $4 or $5, and all that you get is like $200 on your bridge car, and about 2 or 3 weeks, you'll be gone. You know what I'm saying? But you just try to survive. What can you do?
That was Detroit resident Jerome Driscoll speaking with reporter Laura Herberg at the State Fair Transit Center in Detroit. The pace of the COVID-19 outbreak has picked up this week in Michigan. Deaths rose 16% as of yesterday. That's the largest daily jump since the pandemic hit the state. As the heartbreaking statistics are tabulated, it's clear that the pain of the pandemic is not experienced evenly throughout Michigan's communities. Black people have made up more than a third of the viral deaths so far, even though they represent only 12% of Michigan's population. Melissa Crary is an assistant professor of health management and policy at the University of Michigan, and her work is based around public health and medical anthropology. Melissa Crary, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you for having me.
You're teaching a course this semester on race, ethnicity, and culture in health policy. The timing, I can only imagine what this is like to be discussing this academically while all this is playing out. What kind of conversations have you been having with your students lately?
It's an interesting time indeed to be teaching about this. You know, this class is centered on the ways that power structures are built and how equity gets served or not served when it comes to a varied number of topics. So we have course conversations about housing and immigration. We have one next week on turning the lens local to Michigan and what this means for Flint. This being a general question of equity, but we're going to be able to turn those conversations specifically about COVID-19 with the executive director of someone who works in Flint for the water crisis. So if you can imagine all the things that are compounded in a place like Flint that is still reeling from a water crisis and then having to add layers of issues concerning COVID-19. So my class talks about all of the ways that these intersections of injustice and equity can and do occur in health. And the students are often pretty equipped. University of Michigan, particularly in the School of Public Health, produces students that are thinking about these things and are really engaged in the topic and ready to go.
Considering that there are some things that you can work into the curriculum right now in real time, and that there are some things we may learn later when we have a more complete statistical picture of the virus's path, what do you feel like this moment has to teach us about public health?
Well, public health is definitely having a moment right now. There are so many lessons that can be brought down, I think, both practical, but also kind of, you know, emotional. So some of the things that I'm thinking about is that disease is not just about biology. That disease is, yes, something that occurs and may lead you to the doctor's office, but public health has said over and over again about how we have to be paying attention to the social determinants of health. So what are the upstream things that are leading individuals to actually intersect with the healthcare system? And so the social piece is just as important as the biological piece. And I think that truly COVID-19 is illuminating that for all of us right now. And what it also is illuminating is that the disadvantages that one has in terms of access to insurance or access to clean water or access to secure food supplies, all those things have a real and deep impact on health and how one takes care of themselves. And of course, in a healthy situation, in a normal situation, but in a COVID situation, or in a situation in which one is trying to avoid the coronavirus, it becomes much more acute.
We've received very stark numbers in recent weeks about the toll that the new coronavirus is taking across population demographics, and especially the African-American community. Do you have any concerns about how that data has been reported and interpreted?
Yeah, there's been a lot of conversation about the withholding of data from either federal or state sources. And I think there are a few things that should be taken into consideration. When it comes to data being reported by the CDC, you know, they need accurate sociodemographic data from the states, and it has to be valid and reliable. So a self-report on race might be considered valid, for instance, but the data that I think the CDC is receiving are coming from state health departments, and that data is being translated from hospital systems. You know, EMRs and healthcare data is notoriously bad when it comes to variables like race. If you're in a place place like University of Michigan, a really strong academic medical center, yes, of course, elements like race might be collected. But if you're thinking about a much smaller healthcare system or a system that just doesn't focus on research as much, then we can see the ways in which race may or may not be collected. So I think it's important to think about the data and what's available. So then if and when we get the data, well, then what? It can tell us where the burden is being most felt. It can help us guide resources and messaging and send money and personnel, but it has to be responsibly interpreted. You know, and understanding there is a cautionary tale for data being weaponized against certain populations and, you know, data being used to further stigmatize and potentially create more harm than good. So we have to be careful that when data that is connected to race becomes available, that those who need to see it, and I'm not sure that everyone does need to see it, but those that do need to see it are taking the right steps to ensure that it's being used responsibly.
Detroit is the site of a new study. It's just in the early stages on whether hydrochloroquine can be effective in preventing the spread of the virus. Henry Ford Health System is looking for about 3,000 healthcare workers and first responders to test out what there's been just a lot of speculation about. And we've been hearing some reaction among people who look at the history of medical research and the history of the pharmaceutical industry and feel some trepidation about whether African-American lives in Detroit will be valued at a time like this, when there's an awful lot of pressure to get some answers about what's effective. Can you remind us what might be informing some of those feelings?
When I talk about using data responsibly, all of this harkens into mind a very long history that the United States has had when it comes to the valuing of certain bodies. So certain bodies are valued for research purposes, but maybe not valued in other ways. And Black and brown bodies in the research complex and used throughout for the collection of data has been widely looked at. And we know from things like the Tuskegee study, there is a troubled history which shows how medical institutions, public health institutions have played a role in not acting in accordance to what's ethically correct in terms of making sure the patient population is being well looked after and ethically taken care of. And so when we're thinking about the fast-paced nature of how this data is going to be collected, it's important to ask questions, you know, who is going to be at the core of the subject population here? How is consent going to be collected? How is privacy going to be maintained? How are the effects of the study going to be reported out? Who are making these larger decisions, and are any community voices involved? And again, this is going really quickly, but it would make sense to make sure that we get ahead of any potential issues that comes down when we're thinking about the fraught nature of researching this on a body of people that's already so disadvantaged in many ways when we're thinking about the COVID-19 crisis.
You've been working on a concept called bounded justice as it refers to health policy. Could you explain what that means and how it took shape?
Bounded justice is a biopolitical concept that I've been working on that illuminates how programs and policies and technologies focused on justice do so without recognizing how society impinges on the justice delivery system. So we often think about inclusion and getting people to the table, but we don't really think about the reasons that brought people to the table to begin with. Bounded justice takes into account that these beneficiaries of people that we're trying to deliver this justice to, that they've been historically embodied with cumulative effects of marginalization. Maybe that intended justice doesn't get delivered in the most effective way. So it won't matter if state and local government and private corporations and philanthropic groups, you know, want to help, that they want to throw money at a situation, that they're really intent on, creating an arena for social justice to be delivered, if it's done through these Band-Aid policies and we're not thoughtful to the longstanding injustices that have been embodied due to these larger structural barriers, then we just have to question how the justice gets delivered and how effective it will be. And I really think this moment illustrates how bounded justice might work in terms of questioning the limits of health equity and COVID-19 in particular, when we're thinking about all the ways that we want to do good, that we want to use this data for justice for certain populations, that we want to make sure that distributive justice is present and that people are getting the resources that they need. It's important to think about all the ways that the fabrics of society, like racism and discrimination and sexism and homophobia, all those things will impede all of the good that people are thinking will actually get done once we are able to think about things in an equitable manner.
Can you give us an example of what this might mean, maybe through the lens of COVID-19?
Well, I see bounded justice particularly shaping out in just the ways that, you know, we've been having this conversation. When we think about the policies involved for particular communities, disadvantaged communities in particular, when we think about the future of vaccine development and distribution, when we think about, you know, making sure that certain areas are able to get access to testing or access to the future vaccine or access to increased amount of health communication and resources in general. All of that is with great intent to make sure that we are delivering a particular kind of social justice through health and health equity towards certain populations. But then if we're not thinking thoughtfully about the fact that these populations have so much disadvantage baked into the system structurally, the access to health and access to healthy foods, access to education and job opportunities, all of those things that have impacted the livelihoods over generations, it's not going to be easy to just go in and apply a quick fix.
I don't know if I'm on the right track, but would it maybe be looking at what's happening in Metro Detroit right now and saying it's not enough to have a robust COVID response if you've got communities where many people have their water turned off.
Absolutely.
And so have a greater vulnerability to the disease in the first place. It's more the looking at the front end than the back end.
It's about understanding that these deep structural barriers that are present for certain communities, that we have to assume the things that we want to do to help these communities, that we're going to have to unpack a little bit deeper the notions of how we can actually get the justice that we need to these certain populations. But we have to unpack and kind of fix the things that have been deeply baked in, the actual root of the inequality that, again, brought people to this table to begin with.
What might structural change in Michigan's public health look like?
Things like regulations are necessary, but not just health-related ones. We need regulations around the access to food. We need regulations for better housing and for job opportunity, not tying education to property taxes. Again, this is what bounded justice gets at, is unpacking the actual structural barriers before we can apply the justice-intended kind of Band-Aid policies. My colleague John Ianian showed in a study a while back that Medicaid expansion increased jobs and income and tax revenue for the Michigan economy. And that's good for Michigan, but more importantly, that's good for Michiganders and their overall well-being and health. So when we're thinking about, you know, structural change, we're thinking about things like Medicaid policies, Medicaid expansion, better housing policies, making sure that everyone has access to good and nutritious food, that there are, you know, a decreased number of food deserts, that environmental hotspots are being cleaned and not in places that are specifically where disadvantaged populations are accessing. It's about this broader structural well-being that takes a lot of effort, involves the idea that a lot of the resources are going to go to those that are disadvantaged, which means that not everyone's going to get at the same time. And that's a hard thing to think about. the undercutting and underfunding of public health has to stop, and it has to remain a priority in the eyes of everyone.
Melissa Crary is an assistant professor of health management and policy at the University of Michigan. Melissa, thank you very much for your time. We hope you're staying safe.
Thank you.
That's our show for today. Tomorrow, we'll speak with poet and writer Anne-Marie Oman from her home up north.
Well, the quiet is something I think that we hadn't realized we would enjoy.
I'm April Baer. Thanks for listening. We'll catch up with you tomorrow. You stay safe.